Now, I must say something about spirituality proper. That's what I'm trying to do. Now, what is spirituality? How is it different from religion? As I mentioned at the very beginning, if you read San Francisco Chronicle every day, you are not likely to be a great fan of God or religion. That's a reality. So when we read the Sermon on the Mount or the Bhagavad Gita or Dharmapada or any of the great spiritual literature, we feel, oh, how wonderful. But again, when you read San Francisco Chronicle, you see a different interpretation, different approach, different understanding of God and religion, a mighty, uncompromising creator God sitting above the clouds with a very big stick in his hands, who's looking for those who are very loyal to him, obedient to him, do what he wants them to do. Unfortunately, very often religion has got a bad name these days. But religion is not responsible for that. The founders of religion are not responsible for that. People who pretend to profess religion without actually doing that are responsible for that. In modern times, Swami Vivekananda, historically speaking, and he's the first great teacher who did that in Western world, drew a clear line of demarcation between religion and spirituality. You can be religious and you can be a bloodthirsty, cruel monster. But you cannot be spiritual and be cruel or monstrous or inhuman in your interaction with others. So spirituality is something that goes beyond religion as we understand it, as it is unfortunately understood for the last several centuries. Religion sometimes can become reduced to the status of a prisoner confined within the four walls of a belief system, a book, a place of worship, and belief, fanatical belief in the exclusiveness and finality of the teachings of the founder of that particular religion. That's the main problem. But true religion has got a lot about it. It could be sublime, it could be unifying, it could make you better human beings, it could make you look upon the whole humanity as one spiritual family. It could be unifying. It could make us feel the presence of the divine within us and experience the same divine presence everywhere. Then why there is so much a conflict in the name of religions? You know, normally there are four stages that we go through in religious life. At the most primitive stage, we believe my God lives in a temple or a church or any place of worship. He'll be very happy if I read that particular scripture, which I may consider to be the embodiment of all the wisdom of God. And certain mechanical rituals which I perform every day or every week in a very mechanical way, and believe in some sort of an intermediary between God and humanity. So priestcraft, place of worship, scripture, and of course, a kind of mechanical ritualisms. Now, this is not wrong from Vedantic perspective, but this is a kindergarten of religion. You don't begin and end your education at the kindergarten. Your goal is to go to Harvard. Then only you would be considered to be an educated person. And as you grow, as you evolve, as you become more broad-minded, your understanding, your definition of God also evolves and grows. And after some time, you may feel, well, even if I can't go to a place or a worship or a temple or a church or read a scripture or perform a ritual mechanically. Still, I can feel the presence of God sitting in my home by doing good things, by thinking good thoughts, by trying to be a good human being. And at a still higher level, you can feel the presence of God, the invisible presence of God, His hand guiding you, your actions, your thoughts, and your life as a whole. At the highest level, you feel, well, you don't need to go to a temple or a church or a place of worship. You can feel the presence of God in every human being, in everything in this creation. You don't do harm to another person because the other person is not different from you. Physically may be different, but not spiritually. So when you experience the presence of this divine within you and also outside, without, that is called spirituality. One important proof is it makes you a better human being. So that's why Vedanta is often defined as kind of universal spiritual humanism. The problem is, as I mentioned earlier, we pay too much attention to rich secondary details. So if I read the Bible, I can see wonderful messages, teachings in the parables, in the Sermon on the Mount. If I read Eckhart, I would find many things not different from what I find in the Upanishads, which of course were written thousands of years earlier. And again, when I pray with a sincere heart, as Swamiji was mentioning, with a heart, then if I compare the way I pray with the way with a devout Catholic or a Jewish or Buddhist pray, I won't find it much difference. So at the experience level, when we evolve, when we grow beyond the external rituals, beyond theology, beyond mythology, beyond even philosophy, when we actually feel the presence of God within us and the presence of the God everywhere, it is called spirituality. So if you read, as I mentioned just now, if you read the works of Eckhart and Upanishads and the Gita, there are many striking similarities. So the point is, we must try to evolve ourselves and go beyond this. You find a similar evolution in the concept of interfaith conversation, interfaith dialogue. At the most primitive stage, exclusivistic approach, exclusivism. My religion is right. My God is okay. Your religion is wrong. Your religion is devil. It's simple. That makes you worse than an atheist. In fact, it is better to be an atheist than to be a fanatic. Because an atheist has some moral principle, what you call dharma. Atheism, there are very wonderful radical humanists, atheists, agnostics, who are very wonderful people, who appreciate good things everywhere. They may not be willing to believe in a God as we understand or as it is ordinarily understood by the people who don't care for spiritual values. So it's almost like a political dogma. So true religion is not a doctrine. It's not about surrendering our spiritual freedom to an almighty creator God, some kind of a muscular, uncompromising person with a heavy stick in his hand, with a long list of things that you are not expected to do, unless you want to go to hell. And things which you are supposed to do if you want to go to heaven. So such radical humanists, atheists and agnostics, not all of them, but quite a good number of them are very good people. So once you go beyond exclusivism and reach the dialogical approach, you find the foundation of dialogical approach is spirituality. Between these two, there is another approach which is not so very important called syncretism. Where I know in the 70s or 80s, even in Berkeley, I heard There are many liberal-minded Americans who thought Christianity was all bad because nobody goes to churches. So let's all become Buddhists or Vedantins, which is totally wrong from Vedantic perspective. A Vedantin won't accept you if you say Christianity is wrong. I'm going to become a Vedantin. A true Vedantin and a true Hindu will not accept it because Vedanta is the highest spiritual evolution, the highest fruit of Hindu spiritual evolution. All these great Vedantic teachings that Vivekananda brought to the West in the 19th century were articulated in the ancient Sanskrit works in the 8th century by Shankaracharya, who got them all from the Upanishads, which may be 7,000 years old. So what I mean to say, once we evolve beyond the mechanical level, beyond the level of theology and philosophy, and reach the experience level, then there is no conflict. There is a famous verse, which I don't want to quote too much, but one important verse is that, which is the foundation of interfaith. Mandukya Karya, it comes. So Siddhanta Vivasthasu Dvaitino Nischita Dhritam Parasparam Virudhyande Tairayamna Virudhyade. It's a very wonderful picture you get here. What the great philosopher Gaudapada says is this. People who believe in this exclusivism, religious exclusivism, is a kind of fanaticism. They fight among themselves, saying, my God is the real God, not your God. If your path is different from mine, it means I'm right, you're wrong. This is totally wrong, according to Vedanta, according to the true spirits of Hindu religion. That's what Gaudapada says. So you cannot hurt anyone. You cannot criticize anyone unless you want to criticize yourself. You cannot do any harm to anybody unless you actually want to harm yourself. So that is the approach of Vedanta. Then why do we look upon other religions as alien, different and distinct and wrong approaches? Often I use this illustration. You think of climbing a mountain. And your goal is to reach the top of the mountain. The top of the mountain corresponds to experience. At the lower level, there are so many tracks and trails and roads that you can take. If you want to take one road, it's okay. Another person can take another trail. Another person, still innumerable trails leading to the same top of the hill. The top of the hill is spirituality, experience. But when you are following one trail, you believe that I am the only traveler. You don't know that there are other roads which are used by other hikers, travelers, who are struggling to reach the same top of the hill. You realize that there are so many trails which lead to the same top of the hill. So many religions are so many trails which all eventually lead to the top of the hill. You realize this fact only when you reach the top. Because before you reach the top, you have no idea that there can be so many other trails and other passengers, other pilgrims trying to reach the same spot, the experience. So Vedanta says true spirituality is built upon the foundation of experience. Now, this experience can be of several dimensions, several varieties. Just now, as I was closely listening to Professor Barbara's exposition, just think of a man like Dostoevsky portraying the saintly picture of Father Zosima or Alexei, the young novice, or if you read the Grand Inquisitor, Dostoevsky was fully drunk, as a matter of fact, as most of you know, could write such a wonderful masterpiece, which is considered to be the greatest creative writing in the history of modern literature, with the Brothers of Karamazov. So given a great literary genius, who may not have meditated really, we don't know, of course. At least you don't call Dostoevsky as a saint. by any extension. Even Russian Orthodox Church priests won't go to that extent of calling him a saint. But he had a glimpse of what a saint could experience within. And you find this in the creative writings of many other great literary giants. A glimpse of the universal spiritual truth. That's what makes their writings classics. Their writings are read and will be read for generations. So coming back to spirituality, what I meant to say was, when your concept of God evolves and it becomes more and more subtle, more and more real, and when you approach God closer and closer through experience, when you get a glimpse of that experience, then you feel, well, I cannot do any harm to anybody, because by doing harm to another person, I'll be doing harm to myself. Now, if we go to San Francisco Old Temple, there is an inscription, Ekam Sat Vipra Bhagudha Vadanti. This is a Sanskrit verse. It comes from the Rigveda Samhita. Indra Mitram Varunam Agni Rahu Adho Divyasa Suparno Garudman. Egam Sadvipra Bhagudha Vadandi Aknim Yamam Atarishwanamahu. Don't worry about the Sanskrit verse I'm going to explain. You know, in ancient times in India, there were no temples in Vedic age. People used to worship so many deities. Agni, fire god, sun god, let us say so many, like Greek mystery religions. But there was a spiritual foundation behind. What this sage tells us is this. All these are different names which people belonging to different cultures, different religious traditions, different social categories try to explain and describe and call. But the reality is one. The reality is one, but that reality can be approached from different angles. By great men and women born in any culture, any tradition, even in traditions we did not really have a concept of God, by leading pure life, they will discover the presence of some transcendental, spiritual, divine spark within themselves. So, remember, God, religion is a creation of human beings, not of God. The teachings of Jesus existed before Jesus. You cannot say the teachings of Jesus were produced, manufactured by Jesus Christ. Truth, a supreme truth, cannot be manufactured. A great truth can be given new interpretation, a new articulation, a new presentation. So all great spiritual teachers of the world are to be accepted and respected and revered with the same respect. Because the great mystics, the founders of great religious traditions, have reached the top of this hill. That is spirituality. This is the foundation of dialogical approach. In dialogical approach, I interact with you, though your religion is different. I discuss with you about God and religion and practices. Not as a concession. All right, you are wrong. Still, let us have a dialogue. You know, a deal. So, no, not in that sense. Your religion is your approach. Wonderful. If you are true, if you are sincere, earnest, lead a pure life, then God doesn't insist that you should, this is my name, you call me by this name, the correct phonetic pronunciation. No. See, the place of residence of God in our hearts, just mentioned earlier. That's why this dialogical approach, which is the foundation of universalism and pluralism in interfaith conversations, is built upon the foundation of spirituality. And that again is based on the fundamental principle that the goal is the same, but paths may be different. Once we take this approach, then religion becomes a harmonizing principle. On the one hand, we are able to feel the presence, experience, not just believe in. Anyone can believe in, you know. Belief only in the ordinary sense, it is very superficial. Everyone say, I believe in God. But I would say, if he's sincere, it only means, I shall try to believe in God. You don't have to say, I believe in something that you really believe in. You don't say, no, I believe I'm in Ulima right now. It's a fact. If you really believe in, you don't make a statement about it. Shankaracharya says, you know, and he says in the very interesting context, what is obvious to you, you don't make a statement about it. And you cannot deny it. So when a sincere spiritual seeker says, I believe in God, he only means, or she only means, I am trying to believe in God. Once that belief becomes an experience, then you don't have to believe in what you actually experience. When you say you believe in, it means you have not experienced it. So all the great teachings of great mystics of the world are based on this principle of inner experience. So true religion is all about discovering or trying to discover. It's a pilgrimage in search of the supreme spiritual truth within us, not outside. We have to begin with the search from outside. You know, every religious tradition, as at the grossest level, you read a scripture. Sometimes you have to do some practices mechanically. Nothing wrong when you practice something mechanically, because nothing wrong if you begin your spiritual education in the spiritual kindergarten. There's a spiritual kindergarten. A child has to scrawl alphabet in a big slate because he has to memorize. So we can do that. But we should not interpret that as the end of education. We should not interpret as the final word in our spiritual journey. The problem arises because we give too much of importance to socio-anthropological aspects of religion. Look at, say, Christianity and Hinduism, or Judaism, or Buddhism. Buddhism and Hinduism predominantly have an Indian background geographically and culturally. And Christianity and Judaism have a background in Judeo-Christian, the Middle Eastern, Palestinian background. So the language, for example, used by Jesus Christ or even the later theologians, St. Paul and others, will have a pastoral touch. The vocabulary, the language, the illustrations, the parables, imageries will be from the particular socio-cultural foundation. Because every prophet is burdened with this limitation. He has to use the language that he's born into. He has to use the language, the imageries, the illustrations prevalent in the culture in which he's born. It is not his fault. It is inevitable. Now, again, if you come to Buddhism and Hinduism, for example, many of the stories, if you read, let's say, Buddha's previous incarnations, you know, Jataka tales, 554 previous life cycles of Buddha are illustrated, explained in Jataka tales. All these stories have any predominantly South Asian or Indian cultural, social background. But you take Buddha's teachings, let us say, the symbol work, is a Dhammapada, which is many innumerable English translations. There are Heart Sutra, as you call it, you know, is famous. If you take any of these well-known works which are available in English language, and you compare those teachings, say, with the central teachings of Sermon on the Mount, or the parables of Jesus, or if you read the autobiographical writings of St. Teresa of Avila, or St. John of the Cross, or the great Russian mystical work in the Way of a Pilgrim, you find there are many striking similarities when you go beyond the socio-anthropological level. When you look through them and beyond them. When you reach the experience level, you suddenly are struck by the surprising truth that all religions contain some universal spiritual truths, which can be practiced by anybody and which are of universal relevance. The socio-anthropological conditions, conventions and traditions and food habits, for example. Some time back, you know, when I was giving a lecture in this country, a devotee who asked a question, Swamiji, is it possible to be spiritual without becoming a vegetarian? She said that she became a vegetarian very recently. And for my part, for the last hundreds of generations, we have been vegetarians. Can't go anywhere near fish and meat. But I told her, food is not the ultimate criterion. Food is a very unimportant, very insignificant factor. Hitler was a vegetarian. And the lady happened to be a Jewish lady. So you don't have to go further. Nobody will understand the comparison better than a Jewish lady, which she happened to be. So where do you stand? Food habits, for example, that you find mentioned in the biblical literature or in the European mystical literature. You find the Christian fathers, Christian monks making wine in Christian monasteries, Franciscan, Dominican monasteries in Europe. Such a thing is inconceivable in India. But that doesn't make them unspiritual. These are secondary factors. What you eat doesn't make you spiritual. What comes out of your mouth is what makes you spiritual. Anyone can eat the best food and throw out the worst poison, as you happen in many cases. So these are examples of how people become fanatics, praying to one particular kind of God, to one side of the world, eating one kind of food, one kind of cloth, and that makes you spiritual. Not at all. Spirituality transcends, goes beyond all these secondary details related to culture, conventions, practices, food habits, dress code, and so on. Spirituality is universal. It is humanistic. It makes you better human beings. So that's why in 19th century, Swami Vivekananda, when he interpreted religion, he gave a new dimension to the very paradigm of religious life. He called it universal religion. Universal religion is not another religion. Universal religion is the way of focusing on the universal teachings of all great religious traditions. Going beyond, overlooking conflicts and diversities, problems of secondary details, and interpreting universal teachings on the basis of secondary details. That's an important point. Two possibilities are there. One, you may interpret the universal spiritual teachings of a great religion in terms of secondary details. So I eat one particular kind of food, everyone who wants to be spiritual should eat that kind of food. That's how a great spiritual idea can be reduced to a very narrow, limited dress code or food habits. On the other hand, what you eat, how you dress yourself, what language you speak, what illustrations you use are secondary details, incidental factors. Going beyond them, there is one important idea, that is spirituality. And spirituality is trying to experience the presence of God, not in the temple alone, but also within our hearts, and simultaneously trying to feel the presence of God in other people's hearts also. That's an important point. So in the Vedantic tradition, there are four important statements, of which two are most important. One is a statement of instruction. The other is a statement that corresponds to experience. You know, you are taught a great lesson. You are given this instruction, Tattvamasi, which is mentioned earlier, means You are that supreme truth. The God you are seeking in temples and churches, He is there, no doubt, but He is outside also. He is present within you. Try to manifest this presence of God within you by becoming a good human being through your actions, noble thoughts, pure life. That's why Vivekananda says, you live your life in such a way that God will accept you even if you don't accept God. That's how Vivekananda articulated a new paradigm of religious life that goes beyond conventional definitions of religion. So as I mentioned, one problem is we try to interpret the universal in the language of the relative, the incidental, the secondary details. What we should do is we must focus on the universal teachings, the humanistic teachings, the spiritual teachings of all scriptures. But there are religions which will tell you you cannot change a comma or a colon. I am not mentioning any particular tradition. That could be one problem. Perhaps, you know, can we say that God, you spoke one particular language, used to eat one kind of food, and expected one prophet to speak exclusively for him and condemning the rest of the humanity? It is against logic and is against simple spiritual common sense. So we must be able to look beyond the secondary details, beyond the secondary aspects of dress code, social habits, customs, and so on, and focus on the universal aspects. Then, you know, the ideal of unity in diversity can be easily understood. Unity in terms of the universal teaching, central spiritual theme of all world scriptures, and diversity in terms of secondary details. Secondary details need not be neglected. They have their own way. So the point is, but the truth should be understood. If your religion is different from my religion, it doesn't mean, it should not mean that your religion is wrong, my religion is right. You say both of us are approaching the same goal, same God, from two different angles. The prophet or the teacher who taught me my religion happened to be born in a different place, spoke a different language, ate a different kind of food, and had a different kind of dress. And the teacher or the prophet who taught your religion was born in a different place. So these differences are there. But when you go to the content, you find it's the same. So what we call spirituality is the experience of the divine within our hearts and the experience of the same divine everywhere. And that makes you a better human being. That experience invokes compassion, kindness, Catholicism, tolerance, acceptance, generosity, and broad-mindedness in our interactions with others. So true religion is nothing but trying to become a good human being, a good human being in the most profound universal sense. A good human being is one who looks upon the whole humanity as one spiritual family. I shall conclude this very brief exposition with one very interesting dialogue from an ancient spiritual classic. It's a very famous classic. Nine sages went to a king. In those days, sages and philosophers used to visit kings and emperors in their courts. So when they reached there, the king put them a number of questions. There were many questions. Who is a true devotee of God? Who is a truly wise person? What is the meaning of spirituality? What makes a person truly spiritual? And so on. One important question was, who is the dearest, noblest, highest devotee of God? So in response to this question, the sage gives three answers. First, he says, well, the one who sees the presence of God everywhere and the presence of the whole existence creation in God. He is the highest devotee. So sarva bhudeshu yapasyet bhagavad bhavam atmanaha bhudani bhagavadi atmani esha bhagavatottamaha. So this is one thing. The one who sees the presence of the whole humanity in God and presence of God in everyone, in everything. You know, called spiritualizing the secular, not secularizing the spiritual as it frequently happens. So when you give too much importance to secondary details, you are secularizing the spiritual. When you focus on the spiritual, overlooking differences and diversities at the lower secondary levels, then you are spiritualizing the secular. So the one who experiences the presence of God in everyone and the presence of everyone in God, one who looks upon the whole humanity as one spiritual family, he is the highest devotee. He doesn't say, the one who comes to my temple every day, or the one who prays to me every day, the one who draws a check of donation to my temple or a church every day. No, what he says is this. The one who feels the presence of God in everyone and the presence of everybody in God is my best devotee. Then he says, who is the worst one? In between, there are the intermediary one. The worst one is, he goes to a temple or a church or any place of worship, reads scriptures every day, very, very punctual, lot of fasting, lot of wonderful prayers, you know, 10,000 people gathering in a big place like this, more of a physical exercise than a kind of internal spiritual journey. They are the worst. They feel the presence of God in my temple. But when they come out of the temple, they feel there is no God. It is the worst blasphemy to limit the all-pervading reality within the prison walls of a small structure made of concrete and mortar. He said, actually, God won't feel amused because he's so omnipresent, so transcendental, and you limit him within the prison walls of a small, tiny structure, or a temple or a church, whatever it may be. He's the worst. Then in between, there is another one. Those who are evolving. He says, they are those who practice compassion towards fellow spiritual seekers, friendly feelings towards other spiritual seekers, who have admiration for those who are more evolved than they themselves, and no contempt for those who are not able to make progress, who are trying to, in their everyday life, trying to gradually evolve, leaving behind the lowest level of not seeing God outside the place of worship, forgetting the presence of God outside the place of worship, or thinking that God is staying in this particular small concrete structure, not beyond that. That's the worst kind of blasphemy. Those who are beyond that stage, left that stage behind, and trying to evolve to a higher level of universal spirituality, they belong to the second level. The highest are those who, for whom every day, every moment is an occasion for celebration because they feel, as Brother Lawrence said, the presence of God everywhere. Incidentally, this concept is not limited to Vedanta. I often used to mention, if you read the Way of a Pilgrim, you find when the pilgrim learned the Jesus prayer from a Russian Orthodox monk, when he learned it, when he became identified with this prayer, when he actually experienced what St. Paul said in the first epistle, you know, to be always in a state of prayerfulness. Not that you pray 2 hours in the morning or 1 hour in the evening. No, you cannot but be always in a state of prayerfulness, a state of perpetual prayerfulness. When this pilgrim, a poor man, hardly literate, so he could write, read and write, became a man of experience, when he reached the experience level of Jesus' prayer, you find he says, oh, he felt so much of compassion, so much of inner fulfillment, completeness. And for him, the whole humanity is one spiritual family. So such persons cannot hate anybody on the basis of religion, because when you hate another person just because his idea of God is different, it is the worst kind of blasphemy, an insult and sacrilege to God whom we worship in our own temple or our own church. So when we reach this level, it is no more religion, it is called spirituality. So when spirituality becomes the foundation of interfaith conversation, it is sometimes called dialogical approach. And incidentally, all of you have reason to be proud, because this concept in modern times historically got established with the first Parliament of Religion in 1893 in Chicago, which was held as a part of the Columbian Exposition, which again was part of the celebration of Columbus' 400th anniversary celebrations of Columbus' discovery of the United States, the new continent. And America had the privilege of, historically speaking, bringing all the delegates of different religious traditions on a single platform and articulate, of course, there are many aspects about it, articulate this universal spirituality, this spiritual universalism, historically speaking. Before that, there were two attempts in India during the time of Ashoka the Great in the 2nd century BC. Ashoka brought in a single platform all the delegates of different religious traditions of India at that time in 2nd century BC. Then Akbar the Great in the 16th century tried to do the same, but it did not take off. But in 1893, when this Parliament of Religion was held, on which occasion, on a single platform, all the religious delegates of different traditions came to the United States and spoke with one another, had the first interreligious dialogue, historically speaking, modern times. So thank you. And I'm very happy that America had this unique privilege of indirectly continuing this tradition through this Olema interfaith programs. Thank you. Namaskar.